Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Today, we're doing a deep dive into something that, well, might seem like old tech in genomics, short-read DNA sequencing. You know, we hear so much about the fancy long-read technologies stitching together perfect genomes, but what happens when your DNA isn't perfect? What if it's, like, really old or fragmented? Degraded.
That's exactly the point. It's a huge issue. Our mission today is to unpack this fantastic review paper, arguing that short read sequencing isn't just hanging around. It's actually fundamental right now. It's like the essential bridge connecting these incredible, irreplaceable historical collections with the massive goals we have today, you know, like sequencing all life on Earth.
I like that, the bridge, because it really tackles this paradox we have. We've got this huge global mission, right? The Earth Biogenome Project, trying to catalog all the planet's genomic diversity.
Exactly. A massive, inspiring goal. But then, bam, reality hits. Say you need to sequence a really rare species, maybe a beetle collected, I don't know, 70 years ago, or a plant sample from some remote field trip. The DNA you get back is often super fragmented, maybe chemically damaged. Sometimes there's barely anything there.
And you just can't feed that messy, degraded DNA into the newest, shiniest long-read sequencer and hope for the best. It won't work.
Right. Long-read tech needs high-quality, long, intact DNA strands. It's unattainable for a lot of these priceless museum samples or those rough field samples.
So, okay, here's the twist the authors highlight, the really interesting part. The solution isn't some futuristic new machine.
No, it's about being smarter with the tools we already have, using the reliable short-read technology better. By figuring out how to squeeze more information out of these tiny fragmented sequences, which actually are a perfect match for the already fragmented state of old DNA. We're basically transforming this archive material, stuff people thought was maybe useless for genomics, into incredibly valuable resources today.
Okay, that sets the stage perfectly. And we're drawing these insights from a really comprehensive review paper. The title is The Untapped Potential of Short-Read Sequencing in Biodiversity Research.
Yeah, well, we should definitely take a moment to, you know, recognize the team behind this synthesis. It's crucial work. We're talking about Christoph Bleidorn, Felicia Sandberg, Sebastian Martin, Alfred P. Vogler, and Lars Podsiakoski. And they're associated with some major institutions like the University of Göttingen, the Leibniz Institute, Imperial College London, the Natural History Museum, ETH, Zurich. It really shows this is a global effort. They've mapped out the role of this tech beautifully.
Let's talk about the why now. Why is this need for rapid, affordable, flexible sequencing so urgent at this particular moment?
Well, it ties directly into conservation policy. The coming Montreal Global Biodiversity Framework, the GBF. That framework has this huge goal: halt human-caused species extinctions. But you can't protect species if you don't know what they are, where they live, or, you know, their basic genomic makeup.
And the traditional way, taxonomy, while super important, it's just too slow, right? For the scale and speed needed today, especially with ecosystems changing so fast, genomics has to step in.
Precisely. Genomic methods are everywhere now, but choosing the right strategy is key. And that's where shotgun short-read sequencing comes back in, you know, where you randomly chop up the DNA into small bits, maybe 50 to 300 base pairs. It's still essential because it's simple, the costs keep dropping, and crucially, it can handle tiny amounts of starting material and really degraded DNA. It's almost uniquely suited to these challenging samples.
Okay, let's dig into the core method that makes this work so well in tricky situations. The key technique they talk about is genome skimming.
Right. Genome skimming is a really strategic approach. Instead of trying to get, say, super deep 50x coverage of the whole nuclear genome for every single sample, which costs a fortune, you do low coverage sequencing, maybe just 5x to 20x coverage, sometimes even ultra low, like less than 5x. You're just sequencing the total DNA you extracted, but not very deeply.
So you're not trying to capture the whole picture in high definition. You're just looking for the brightest points. Why does that even work? How do you get useful data from such low coverage?
Because you're efficiently grabbing the stuff that's there in high copy numbers. Think of it like this. The main nuclear genome is this vast, complex library. But the organeller genomes, the mitochondrial DNA, the chloroplast DNA, in plants, they're like pamphlets printed thousands and thousands of times inside every cell. So even if you only take a shallow scoop, a low coverage skim, you're almost guaranteed to get lots of copies of those mitochondrial and chloroplast genomes. And those are absolute gold for figuring out evolutionary relationships, for phylogenetics, and just identifying species.
Ah, okay, that makes sense. It's like an efficiency hack. But okay, if you can't really assemble the main nuclear genome properly from this skim data, is that it? Is that all you get? Or can you still learn more?
Oh, definitely not the end of the line. The utility goes way beyond just assembling those organelles.
Yeah.
The bioinformatics tools we have now are incredible. They let us use this low coverage, fragmented short read data to estimate two really, really crucial properties of the genome.
Okay, what are they?
Genome size and repeat content. The repeat content is sometimes called the mobilome. If the nuclear genome is the library, the mobilome is all the repetitive stuff, the transposable elements, the jumping genes, all the things that actually make up a huge chunk of complex genomes.
Oh, wait, hang on. How can you accurately measure the size of the whole genome and how much of it is repetitive junk just from tiny fragmented reads?
It comes down to coverage statistics, essentially. There's software, like Respect is one example the paper mentions, that can estimate the genome size based on how often certain unique sequences appear in your low coverage data, even if you only have 1x coverage. And if you know the total estimated size and you can see how much of your data corresponds to highly repetitive sequences, you can start to understand the genome structure. You can look for evidence of big evolutionary events like bursts of transposable element activity, which can really drive adaptation. And you can do this without needing a perfect chromosome level assembly.
Wow. Okay. And the paper also talks about moving completely beyond assembly, these assembly-free methods. That sounds kind of like magic.
Huh. Clever bioinformatics, not quite magic. Think about assembling a genome like trying to put together a massive jigsaw puzzle with millions of tiny pieces. Assembly-free methods basically say, forget building the whole puzzle. They work with k-mers.
K-mers.
Yeah, a k-mer is just a short DNA sequence of a fixed length K, like all the possible 21 base pair sequences in your reads, for example.
So instead of building the picture, you're just comparing the shapes and colors of the individual pieces.
Kinda, yeah. You're looking for genomic fingerprints. Tools like MASH or Skockmer, they analyze how often different commers appear and how they're shared between different samples. Based on that commer profile, they can estimate how similar or different the genomes are very quickly. This lets you build evolutionary trees or classify samples super fast using tools like Read2Tree, often just by mapping reads to known reference spots. It's incredibly efficient for huge biodiversity projects.
Okay, so these methods are great for fragmented data. Where are we seeing the biggest impact? Let's talk about museomics. That sounds really cool.
Yeah, this is where short read sequencing is a total game changer for conservation. Imagine, like, a dusty old butterfly specimen in a museum drawer collected in, say, 1890. Maybe it's the only known example of its species, the type specimen. He held the genomic history of a lineage that might be extinct now or incredibly rare. It's literally irreplaceable.
And the DNA is probably chemically altered, maybe broken into tiny pieces. So the fancy long read machine says, nope.
Exactly. But the short read sequencer, it says, yes, please. Because that historical DNA or HDNA is already fragmented. It's kind of pre-processed for short read tech. So we're turning these museum collections, which are like time capsules of life on Earth, into usable genomic resources. It's amazing.
Do they give concrete examples of this actually working?
Oh, absolutely. The review mentions researchers who got phylogenomic data from 181 historical type specimens of certain sea sponges, the haplosclerids. That's injecting deep evolutionary history directly into our modern understanding. And for plants, another study recovered chloroplast genomes from over 96% and nuclear ribosomal DNA from over 93% of like 672 old herbarium specimens. Think about that for large-scale identification projects. It's like we're resurrecting genomic data that was locked away in these archives.
Wow. Okay, so beyond the museum drawers, how does the short read approach help us understand biodiversity that's, you know, alive and kicking right now?
Well, it tackles a big problem with some common environmental DNA methods. Primer bias. Standard metabarcoding, a popular technique, uses specific DNA primers to amplify certain genes, like ID tags. But primers are like keys designed for specific locks.
So if a species has a slightly different lock, a variation in that gene sequence, the primer key doesn't fit and you miss it. It doesn't show up in your survey.
Exactly. You get a biased view. Short read shotgun sequencing, though, doesn't rely on specific primers. You just sequence everything that's there. So yeah. It gives you a much broader, less biased snapshot of the whole eukaryotic community in a sample. This is the idea behind mitochondrial metagenomics, or MMG. You shotgun sequence a bulk sample like water or soil, and you can assemble the complete mitochondrial genomes of lots of different organisms present. It avoids the PCR amplification bias that often messes up estimates of how much of each species is there.
And there are even newer ID tools coming online, too.
Yes, really innovative stuff. The paper mentions a tool called VAR-coding. It kind of skips traditional assembly altogether. It takes the low-coverage skim data and converts it directly into these pixel-based images, like unique genomic barcodes. Then you can use machine learning, image recognition basically, to identify species incredibly quickly and accurately. It's turning genomic data into a visual signature for AI.
Okay, this is all technologically fascinating, but the whole system, this global biodiversity effort, it really hinges on cost, doesn't it? We can't hit those big GBF goals if sequencing is only for elite labs. The economics must be key.
Absolutely critical. And the cost aspect is why short-read tech isn't just staying relevant. It's actually driving accessibility.
Yeah.
The current standard platforms like Illumina's NovaSeq X, they've already pushed costs down incredibly low. We're talking maybe $2 per gigabase of data, which is already amazing.
But it's not stopping there. The race to the bottom, cost-wise, is still on.
Oh, yeah. It's accelerating. We're seeing new platforms emerging, like Ultimate Genomics with their UG100 system. They use a different chemistry, MNSBS, and they're aiming for around $1 per gigabase. And then there's Roche's upcoming SBX platform, sequencing by expansion. The estimates for that are potentially staggering.
Yeah.
Maybe getting down towards little dollars, 50 second cents.
50 cents. Half a dollar per gigabase. What does that actually mean for conservation globally?
It's democratization. 50 cents per gigabase means that labs in developing countries, researchers with smaller grants, huge long-term environmental monitoring projects, they can all realistically afford high-throughput sequencing now. This cost revolution is what makes achieving those big biodiversity framework goals feasible. It distributes the power to sequence across the globe, not just in a few wealthy centers.
Okay, so let's pull back a bit. We have the Earth Biogenome Project, the EBP, generating these beautiful, high-quality, long-read reference genomes for species. Where does this massive flood of cheaper short-read data fit in? Are they competing or working together?
Totally working together. They're completely complementary. Think of the EBP's high-quality, long-read genomes as providing the perfect blueprint, the detailed scaffold, for one representative individual of a species. But the short-read datasets, they provide the density. They fill in the gaps. They give us invaluable population-level insights. They show us the variation within a species across many individuals and locations.
So the EBP gives us the perfect drawing of a tree, but short reads show us the whole variable forest.
Exactly. A great analogy.
Yeah.
And even if your short-read assembly for a particular sample is quite fragmented, the analysis is still incredibly valuable. Like we discussed, just characterizing the genome's complexity, its size, its repeat content, its mobulum from that fragmented data can reveal really important evolutionary dynamics. Like, did this population adapt rapidly due to a burst of transposable element activity? You can see signatures of that.
I was also really struck by their point about turning contaminants into a resource, the holobiont insight.
Yes. That's a fantastic bonus. When we sequence an organism, say an insect, we inevitably sequence DNA from other things living on or inside it, microbes, symbionts, parasites. Usually the first step is to filter out this contaminant data using tools like Kraken 2 or Consult so you can focus on the host genome.
But the review says, hold on, don't just throw that data away.
Exactly right. Don't trash it. Those supposed contaminant reads are simultaneously a goldmine for studying the hologenome. That's the host, plus all its associated microbes, functioning together as an ecological unit. We can actually use that contaminant data to reconstruct the genomes of important symbionts, like maybe Wolbachia bacteria, in insects, directly from the host's sequencing run. It gives crucial ecological context, often for free.
So before we get to the wrap-up, what are the main hurdles or limitations that the researchers point out still need work?
The biggest remaining challenge is that highly fragmented assemblies from short reads make it really hard to figure out gene order, what genes are next to each other on a chromosome, which we call syntony, and sometimes even accurately count all the genes. You might know the parts are there, but you don't know exactly how they're arranged on the chromosome. So the big next steps are really about improving the bioinformatics. We need better assembly algorithms, specifically designed for highly degraded DNA. And we need better ways to link all this massive short-read data, especially from things like barcoding projects, back to those high-quality EBP reference genomes. Bridging that gap is key.
Okay, time for the core take-home message from this deep dive.
I think the central insight is this. Short read sequencing, powered by these falling costs and really smart new bioinformatics, isn't fading away. It's absolutely essential. It's the affordable, practical bridge for conservation genomics. It connects our irreplaceable history, locked up in museum specimens, with the huge, urgent goal of sequencing all life. And it lets us get fundamental genomic insights, phylogeny, genome size, repeat content, even when perfect DNA just isn't available.
And here's something to chew on. We're now able to integrate genomic data from those historical type specimens, the original examples used to define a species, with modern data. We're building this incredibly deep historical context. So what does gaining this multi-generational view of genomes actually mean for understanding how species have really responded, adapted, or maybe failed to adapt to environmental changes over the last century or more? What secrets does that deep time perspective hold? This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.